Welcome to Season 5 of Game Design Unboxed on the No Direction Network. Danielle Reynolds talks to tabletop game designers about the games they've made. Together, they unbox how the game went from inspiration to publication.
This season is proudly sponsored by Allplay. If you've been following my social media, aka Token Gay Mer, you'll see that my Allplay gaming table gets used on the daily when I'm not flying to different conventions. Between hosting meals on it as a dining room table or removing the panels and adding the cup holders for a Friday night game night as a board gaming table, it gets used constantly. It's also perfect for being a working station for me building my ridiculous amount of prototypes. It honestly gets used more than I ever would have expected. Not to mention, it's great for hiding games and their pieces from my cats. Sans is my little box sitter, while Nova tries to steal the dice as Banshee watches from high atop the cat tower. I've caught them attempting to take dice from Allplay's Sequoia and Mountain Goats, two of my favorite Allplay games that my non-gamer friends adore. We play a lot of party games, and these two, they don't mind me taking out instead. So check out Allplay's tables, bags, playmats, and board games at allplay.com. Thank you for joining me, Danielle, for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, Episode 103, Trekking the World, Second Edition. Today, we are joined by Nick Bentley. He was one of my co-designers on Her Story, so excited to have him on the show. But also, he is the designer of the second edition, as well as the president of Underdog Studio. Thanks for being on the show, Nick.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, I've talked about having you for a while, so it's cool to have a project to focus on.
Yeah. I've wanted to be on for a long time. This is really fun.
Yay. I'm glad you're already saying that and we barely started. For anyone who doesn't know you, mind talking about how you got into the game design industry and designing?
Yeah. A long time ago, circa like 2000, I was doing a PhD program. But I was, and still am, a procrastinator. And I was living with this other dude in the same PhD program who also loved to procrastinate. And we started playing games. And in the course of doing that, I fell in love with games. That love just never disappeared. And it grew and festered like a disease or something. And eventually I started writing a blog about it. And through the blog, I ended up meeting people in the industry. I was eventually hired through that. My first job was at North Star Games. Their most popular games are like Wits and Wagers. Well, actually now probably more the Evolution games. Later hired by Underdog Games. So it's just this obsession that I can't ever stop thinking about. And I eventually came to make my living at it because of it.
I mean, honestly, that's great. I feel like most people who get obsessive about stuff just ends up like buying too many board games or buying too many, I don't know, comic books. And I'm literally just listing the problems I have.
Well, yeah. So I first started out designing games, but I did not think, I mean, I designed games for like, I don't know, a decade or even like maybe 15 years without ever thinking of publishing them. Because my assumption was just like, man, you can't make any money on this stuff. And in my defense, the kinds of games I was designing at first were truly, you could not make any money on them. But then I saw like, oh, people are making money on games that I would not have imagined they would make money on. So then I started studying it. So I kind of got fascinated with it as like, this is a business? What? You know, that kind of a thing.
I totally get that. I mean, because I've played a lot of your favorite games, which are like two-player abstracts, which I am also quite a fan of, but they are so hard to find homes for. Like, it is not an easy feat. So I could see you being like, oh, I don't know how to like quit my day job and make just this my thing. So then let's switch over to Trekking the World, second edition. First off, why was there a need for a second edition?
I don't know if there was a need for it, but I'll tell you our rationale for it. We have like these values at our company to which we try to adhere strongly. Like we don't think values are worth anything unless you really, really try to act on them, right? So our first value is constant improvement. Like we regard ourselves as successful when the next game we make is better than the last game we made. But this is actually a very hard thing to do for like 12 different reasons. But we have some evidence that we've gotten better. So we make this series of games called the Trekking games, which are our most popular games. And the last one we made called Trekking Through History, the mechanics of it were received like a lot more positively than the other ones. And so we've sort of tried to understand what did we do when we made that game that led to such a nice reception. We've come to some conclusions and then we were like, oh, actually, if we could have another shot at one of the earlier games, in this case, Trekking the World, oh, we think we could like make it a lot better. Now, whether we've actually done that, you know, that's for like the people who play and buy the game to decide. But that was the rationale.
That definitely makes sense. It's one of those interesting things where the initial trekking game, which actually was episode 5, and we're already at 103, I had Charlie on talking about, which was the trekking the national parks. And that game is continuing to sell. I know it just like ended up in Target. And it's one that is definitely leans less on the gamer side and more, I would say, on the mass market, like entry level gamer side.
Yeah, that game is our best selling game by a pretty wide margin, but it doesn't have as much to do with the mechanics as it does with the way the game embodies the theme, which people seem to love that.
That's so interesting. Yeah, because I feel like the initial Trekking the World was kind of like a spiritual successor to that initial hit, the National Parks one.
Yeah, it was basically the same mechanics with some tweaks. And this new version of Trekking the World actually jettisoned the core mechanics of the first edition of it for a new set of core mechanics, and we can talk about why. And so now it's no longer like Trekking the National Parks, but it's more its own thing.
Which actually begs the question, why is it a second edition versus a new title?
Oh man, that was a subject of long and intense debate in our company. I don't know if we made the right choice, and I believe that you probably think we made the wrong choice. So
I wasn't gonna say it, but yeah, I was a part of that conversation when you reached out to me. For anyone who's listening, I used to work for Underdog and we still do projects together, but yes, I do feel like you did the wrong choice. I'm curious to see, and everyone else, like, why go second edition versus like Trekking the World with some subtitle of making it a secondary game.
And you may turn out to be right. So a big part of our company story is that we make these gateway strategy games, and a big part of our audience, they're not gamers. So a lot of people who are thinking or who have just discovered modern board games will buy our games. We think a lot about the customer journey, and one of the difficulties with the customer journey for people who aren't familiar with the world that we inhabit every day is it is confusing. So you will find like someone will like look up a game and they'll see, oh, there's like 3 different versions or 4 different versions of this game. It'll be like title, colon, subtitle. And then the subtitle doesn't communicate really clearly, like, what is this compared to that? And so I think the internal rationale of the company, I'm not the one who made the ultimate decision, so I don't want to, like, I'm not totally positive, but the internal rationale is that second edition is like a clear signifier that this is the only version of this game. It's the definitive one. And so if you're just sort of coming to games for the first time, there's less hesitancy. I mean, one thing, another really important point here is that we are mostly a direct-to-consumer sales company. And as such, we have a sort of keen sensitivity to the fact that even a little bit of confusion creates hesitancy and reduces conversion on sales. Even little hesitancies can reduce conversion rates a lot. And so I think that's the big thing. But the big downside, which I think you and many others have argued, is that just calling it a second edition sets up a weird set of expectations for a game whose mechanics have been totally overhauled. Another sort of subtlety here is that one of the points about the game that has received the most praise is the art, graphic design, and production design. Those have remained largely intact because we don't know how to do better for this game.
Oh God, yeah, it was great. Also, still is great because you've used most of the same stuff, just a little bit different graphics and added the new cards and stuff.
Right, so if you're actually looking at it on the table and you're familiar with first edition, you'd be like, oh, this is a second edition, before you know the rules, and the rules are like, oh, they're very different, you know.
Definitely. So it's funny because I actually am currently contracted to work on a second edition or potential spiritual successor of a game. So I was interested to see what your rationale is, because I've also changed most of the core. Like, most of the game is now different, but the core is still the same. So it's interesting. And I was curious to see why it was that you guys decided to go with second edition. I guess it is more straightforward in the fact that first versus second, second probably means it's better, but when you have played the original and you buy the second one for someone, your expectation is going to be very different, because I've played both, and I would say the second edition is way more for gamers than it is for like the person who is just starting to play games.
Yeah, we went a little more gamer with it, for sure.
Yeah, I feel like it definitely took on the trekking through history side more than the National Parks trekking game. But also, for anyone who hasn't played, mind going through how to play the game so they know what we've been talking about?
Yeah, so this is a game where you are sort of competing to be the most fabulous globetrotter. You do that by first on your turn picking an itinerary, which will tell you like how far you can go across the world map, which is the sort of central visual feature of the game. Tell you how much money you're going to withdraw from your bank account and how many souvenirs, if any, you can pick up at your destination. And then at your destination, either nothing can happen, you can have an encounter in the form of picking up a card that gives you some kind of power for the future, or you can take a tour, which costs money, but which will give you points at the end of the game. And then also, as you're picking up souvenirs, those can also gain you like power tokens that sort of feed back into the game and give you special abilities that you can spend later. And a sort of interesting fact about the game is it is quite a bit easier to teach than first edition. So like, just as an example, there's like 40% fewer words in the rule book for second edition than for first edition. But the sort of decision complexity of the game, once you're playing it, is a little more complicated than first edition. So it's this weird combination of streamlined plus a little more gamery decision complexity.
I find that so interesting that you have those stats ready, first off. But also, I know when we worked on Her Story, we were very, very attention, like detail oriented on the rulebook, because rulebooks are, I would say, probably the thing that makes it hardest to get into learning board games. And having a bad rulebook really can wreck you. But the fact that you were able to bring the countdown, but also make it easier for people to learn, that's pretty great. How did you take notes in order to make those adjustments on the second edition?
Well, yeah. So because it was a redesign, it allowed me to think about like how the rules would work as I was building the game. So I could design the game holistically so that once it came to writing the rules would be simpler. And that, like, I cannot emphasize enough how valuable I have found that to be. One note about the rules is that I believe that rules are the single largest obstacle to the adoption of a good game. So the analogy I always make is, imagine an alternative world in which the movie industry, you know, in order to watch a movie, you had to read a manual that was different for each movie. And if you don't read the manual, you don't understand the movie at all. How many fewer movies would we watch, and how much smaller would the movie industry be in that reality? That's the reality of board games.
True. I will say it became a lot easier when YouTubers started making how to play videos.
Oh my God. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. That's like an art in itself. And I've started doing a lot of our how to plays for Wise Wizard games. And it is an art, and I'm learning and maybe getting better at it, hopefully, with each video.
But also, yeah, the videos, the quality of the videos that come out for the games hinge very sensitively on how good the rule books are, because the people who make those videos start with the rule books like everybody else.
Oh yeah. And if they're not like asking questions before putting on those videos, which a lot of times they don't, you have not so great videos. But I know a lot of the more professional ones that you're spending a lot more money on do ask all the right questions or hop on calls to like kind of go over the nuances of the rule book. But yeah, I mean, a good rule book needs to be there.
One more point, something that I've sort of more recently come to appreciate. I interview a lot of our customers about their experiences with us and with other games. And one thing I've heard a bunch of times from our customers is that a number of them decided to back our Kickstarter campaign for Trekking the World Second Edition after having read the rules, like it's the rules that sold them. Now, if you're a marketer, that seems odd, because reading the rules is such a high like commitment activity. But for gamers, a lot of gamers are high commitment people to these sorts of things. And so a great rule book can double as a marketing tool.
I feel like a lot of campaigns don't ever include the rule book, because that is typically one of the last things to get finished when you're going to print, unfortunately. But it also does make sense, because you have to constantly update it anytime any component changes. You got to like make sure all those are correct. But having that available is very useful, because I know me personally, when I first started games, I backed way too many Kickstarters. And now I feel the need to like either play the game before or like have some kind of prior knowledge. And so having that rulebook read, even if it's going to cost me 10, 20 minutes, it means that maybe that game's actually going to get played more than once. And with the amount of space I have in my apartment, I need games that are going to play more than once. So then with Trekking the World Second Edition, why don't you go over just some of the adjustments that happened between the two editions?
Oh my gosh, yeah. I mean, there were so many. So the main thing is that in first edition, you have a hand of cards And those cards act as currency for almost everything you can do in the game. Moving around, taking tours that earn you points, using special abilities that change the game from game to game. And in the new version, you are just drafting an itinerary that tells you what you're going to do on your turn. And it tells you three different steps to take. And each itinerary that you could choose has a different combination of three different things you could do. That is the main sort of thrust of the change out in core mechanic. The main reason this happened was many people have reported that in first edition, the sort of economy of the hand feels tight. And people often feel like they can't really do what they want to do, or their options are too limited by what's in that hand. Before we did the total redesign, we actually, you know, sort of played with that, like how to make the economy feel looser but still retain the hands. And we actually weren't able to do it. So, you know, we would make the card flow through hands a little higher so you felt like you had more to spend. But then the game felt slack, like really slack. And so we're like, it's either too tight or too slack, and we can't figure out how to make it feel just right. And I think part of the problem there was like this really common psychological problem that everybody has in many domains of life called loss aversion, which is that the pain of losing something or giving something away is about twice as big as gaining the same thing. So like there is this issue where people would feel like, oh, I have to spend my card to do this thing to have any chance of winning, but this other thing I'd like to do. And the pain of like losing the card that you needed to do this other thing would be quite high and make people feel bad, even if the math of the game was right. And so basically in changing the core mechanic out, we replaced those kinds of explicit costs with opportunity costs, because you're drafting something from an open draft. And the only cost is the benefits you would have gotten had you drafted something else. And those opportunity costs don't trigger loss aversion like actual physical costs.
And you found that people just responded very positively to all that, it sounds like?
Yeah, for sure. So we do these things called split tests when we're play testing, where we will have players play two games back to back. And like 90% of our split testers say they have preferred second edition to first edition. The only caveat that I can give is I think people who want to buy it as a very light game, like in the way that somebody would buy Trekking the National Parks, it is a little heavier. So if that's not right for somebody, they probably shouldn't buy it. And I would also say, like, just as a general rule, anybody who adores first edition probably shouldn't bother with second edition, because, you know, why mess with something that's just right for you? There's probably a higher chance of regression to the mean in that situation.
Oh, for sure. And I mean, the components are really cool. I like that you guys switched to your little dial for the coin intake.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Big gold coin money wheel.
Mm-hmm. Big fan of that. I love it. And also, I want to bring up your split testing comment. So something that people have found very fascinating when I get interviewed about our game, Her Story, and how our process was with split testing, but us being more competitive, I would say, than collaborative on the design of you and I competing with a split A-B test. Like, I'm A, you're B, take whatever's best and iterate and do it again the next day. Like, I talked about that and how many times we would repeat this and then present whatever one was the favorite of the week. It's so different from how other people design, especially how co-designers design. So yeah, I mean, I'd love for you to go in a little more detail of exactly what those processes look like.
Well, first I should say, what we did, we can't do with everybody. In fact, with a lot of people, I can't do that because, well, it's basically gamifying game design. So for the listener, like Danielle and I would each make our own version of the game, and then we would come into a playtest. Playtesters would play them back to back, and then they would tell us which one they preferred. So you have to have a strong ego to do this, because a lot of times the playtesters will say, your game kind of sucks compared to the other person's game, right?
Yep. But they want to know whose it was.
right. Now, I believe very strongly in ego suppression in game design. Like, I think one of the greatest problems that many game designers face is the ego gets in the way of seeing what needs to be done to have a chance of being good. I mean, even if you can like handle your ego, there's still lots of reasons that your game can be bad. So it's no guarantee, but I feel like it's so easy to get self-satisfied or to tell yourself a story that what you've done is excellent when that's not true. So I actually find it extremely valuable when playtesters splash cold water in my face, be like, nope, what you've done is actually not as good as this other thing. And here's exactly why. And that's actually a really important point. Playtesters, in my experience, because they don't think about the relationship between the minutia of game design and the sort of gestalt experience every day, playtesters are actually not very good at helping the designer understand why they had the experience they had. And my experience with split tests is this actually allows the playtesters to be more articulate in their understanding of their own experiences through comparisons. So they can say, I enjoyed this one more than that one. And the differences in the mechanics, they can start to like point to, it was something about that thing that made this experience better than that experience. And so the designer actually gets better clues about what they should be doing through split tests than just a normal test.
No, I completely agree. I always joke that I'm a massive rejection, and I think that's done me a lot of favors.
Yeah. Publishers
they have no problem just saying no and pass, and they don't even need to give me a reason why at this point, because I'm like, you know, I know most of the reasons. Like, it's not a good fit for them. They have something in their line. Maybe it's just not a good game in general for them, but I don't care. I just like move on to the next one, or I make those adjustments, because a lot of times when I'm pitching games, it's almost like a playtest, because very quickly I'm realizing, oh, well, this is this common thing that's come up multiple times. So maybe this means I need to shelve the design or address whatever that issue is. But I know when we're designing inside a studio, we have our audience in mind. Where playtesters are playing games and figuring out like why they do or do not like it, but they may not even be the audience member. I know with Underdog, you've curated like this awesome playtest group of a bunch of these people that do play your game. So it's like, oh, that's awesome. But not everyone has access to their own audience. Like, most of my games I design now are like entry level or like party games. So I play with people who like don't really know what the hobby looks like outside of like past Catan or whatever.
Yeah, it's interesting. We have this advisor group of like, I think it's up to 25 or maybe 3,500. I can't remember. We have a lot of advisors who are customers who like our games enough that they're on like a special email list where we can solicit playtests online with them. The problem though is that there is a ton of sample bias in the people who sign up for that. And so it's actually not representative of the sort of buying public as a whole. So even though we have that, I don't actually think it solves bias problems that come in playtesting. I've found it's very hard to like actually find a set of playtesters who are representative and unbiased enough to be predictive in any way about how the market as a whole will receive a game once it's on the market.
How do you interact with your advisor group for anyone who's listening?
Yeah, so we have two channels to interact with them. We have a private Facebook group, and then we have an email list. On the email list, I send weekly essays about what we are thinking about and doing in our studio and ask their opinions about it. So some people reply to me through email. And in the Facebook group, we mostly just ask questions. So an example of like a typical kind of question we might ask is we might have two sketches for a cover of a game. And we'll say like, which sketch do you respond to more strongly? That's another example of a kind of split test where rather than just saying, do you like this cover or not? We can say, which do you like more or which do you like less? Or we might ask them about present them a list of possible games we could make and have them comment on which interests them most and why.
Yeah, I will say you have beautiful art and production design, like everyone knows that. But you've also decided recently to be redoing all the covers. What made you guys decide on that?
This comes from the fact that we're a direct-to-consumer sales company. We sell the lion's share of our games through Amazon. So we have access to a lot of data about how different kinds of things convert in Amazon listings and in ads, depending on how those things look. And so we've become sensitive to the fact that the cover of a game can materially change the conversion rate on a listing in a not small way. It can happen in a big way. That leads to a bunch of constraints on covers that I think probably a lot of other designers and publishers don't think about. So for example, the cover, it helps if the cover of a game is totally readable in the form of a tiny little thumbnail that you might see while browsing Amazon on your phone. And that means there needs to be a kind of singularity or focus in the image that you can just see at a glance in that tiny image. Some of the games we make been very hard to figure out how to make an image that reads very clearly in a thumbnail, because our games are about collections of things, like Striking the World, for example. There are many places around the world that you can visit. So if you want to represent like a sort of sample of places that you can visit in the game, you're going to have kind of a crowded cover, which runs in the opposite direction from what you need to make like a fantastic online converting cover. An example I always cite of a cover that has the kind of singularity that we would hope for is Wingspan, which just has a giant bird on the cover, you know? So because of this particular difficulty, we've had to work really hard to make our covers really good. Also, our games are premium and they are priced in a premium way. So if we don't make art that is like just is wows people, we're not actually doing our job. If you have a premium price, it's got to be premium in every way.
Mm-hmm. I feel like you guys do that, because I remember when I was interviewing to work on Her Story, I got to see some of the sample art and I was blown away. As far as the game itself goes, you decided to add a solo mode to it, unlike the first edition. What was the reasoning behind that? And then who worked on it?
Yeah, the main thing is, as you know, I mentioned I interview customers a lot. And so it became totally clear that solo modes have become way more important to our customers in recent years. And I think that's true for everybody. It doesn't actually take interviews to figure that out. So that was the main motivation. And so basically the same motivation that has led probably most other publishers to consider solo modes. But I didn't design the solo mode. There's a young designer named Marceline Lehman, who is really good designer. She was recommended to me by the great Emerson Matsuchi of Century and Foundations of Rome, and Her Story as well. So he teaches like upper level, like master's level game design at the New York University Game Center. And I remember I asked him once, like, hey, who's the greatest student you've ever had? And he named two people, and one of them was Marceline. This is long before I was looking for a designer, but so I kind of like pocketed that name, like, okay, cool. And then later I found out that she had designed a solo mode for another game on which I'm a designer called Oceans by North Star Games. And I read a lot of the comments about that solo mode, and they were sort of very effusive. And so when I was looking for a solo designer for Trekking the World, I'm like, I gotta contact this person. So I did, and she was game to try to make the solo mode, and she did. And I am absolutely certain that at some point in the nearest future, like, most people are going to know this person's name. She's like stupidly good at game design. It was very exciting to work with her. I've had some like electrifying moments just listening to her game design ideas.
Yeah, it's so funny. I've seen your guys' messages in the Slack, and I'm like, oh, you found someone that has your brain. I was like, you found a mini you. Good job.
No, better. Like, the level of her talent is like way beyond, I think, what mine is. I'll ride those coattails.
Hey, that works. I mean, hopefully I'll have her on here someday for one of her own designs.
Yeah.
That's so cool. No, I'm glad that you were able to have all these like collaborations. And honestly, I mentioned Charlie was on here for his initial trekking game. And so how was it working in the same studio with the initial designer? Did Charlie do much of the development, or did he just kind of pass it off to you and it was your baby now? How did that work?
Yeah, so I did the mechanics, but Charlie did art direction and production design. So Charlie Bink, who is the designer of the other Trekking games, he's a former graphic designer, and he's like, you know, one of the very best at that. And like, as we were talking about before, Trekking the World, as well as our other games, are all praised for their art and production design and graphic design. And that's all from Charlie's sensibilities. So there was no way in hell I would be as good at those things as Charlie is. So he was in charge of that. But I was free to run on the mechanics as much as I wanted. And one thing I love about Charlie's, we were talking early about the importance of like not having an ego when you do this. Charlie's like that. Charlie has no ego at all. The way that he thinks about games is he's always looking to understand their weaknesses. Like, he doesn't dwell very much on their strengths.
You guys are so similar in that. It's so funny working with both of you.
Yeah.
I'm a little Miss Happy Energized Bunny, and you guys are like, oh, but this is wrong. I was like, but what if this is good?
Yeah. I do believe that, like, you know, one of the main reasons that games don't do as well as designers are expecting when they go to market is they have not been paranoid enough about how people will experience their weaknesses. I think that's why both Charlie and I focus really heavily on that. Now, there are certainly risks to that as well. So it just introduces a different set of risks. But yeah, so I mean, working with Charlie is just an absolute dream. I love the guy.
Agreed. Big fan. But also biased. When was it okay to make a second edition versus just focusing on a new product? And then what was the timeline from that moment to it actually coming out?
The timeline was, we first got the idea to do it about 3 years after the first edition was published. Now it's coming out 4 years after the first edition was published. Some people have told us that that's not a big enough interval, that like at least 5 is something we should have considered. So that's a note we're going to pocket for later. So yeah, we'll probably, if we ever do this again, you know, probably wait longer. I mentioned earlier that like one of our key values is improvement. We're always asking ourselves, how can we actually be better than we have been, rather than just tell ourselves the story that we are better than we have been? And my experience in life anyway is it's really easy to tell yourself the story that you're improving when you're actually not. It's like, it's another way that the ego like tries to trick you into comfort. One thing about starting from an already published game, especially one that has been reasonably popular, I think we sold like 130,000 copies of first edition, is that there are thousands and thousands of comments online where people who have no connection to you and are very unbiased tell you exactly what they think is wrong with the game and right with the game. The amount of data that you can get, the amount of lenses that you can look through to understand how you might get better is astronomically higher than if you're starting from scratch. Our thesis was we should try to make a second edition of a game, especially because our design principles had evolved and we had other reasons to believe that we could make that game significantly better. So now we have these two sort of lines of thought that both suggested we could actually improve this thing. And so that's actually how we started the design. I spent a few days doing nothing but going through every comment I found online, reading them again, coding them, like, and grouping them, and trying to extract the sort of high points and low points of that first edition so I could sort of understand in a detailed way the problem that we were trying to solve. And that, I gotta say, that was one of the very best things I've ever done for myself as a game designer. Well, I mean, one difficulty about being human is that it is hard to appreciate how different the experience, the lived experiences of others are in all domains of life, but also for games, you know. I mean, the evidence is obvious. If you go to any game and you look at the distribution of ratings, the standard deviance of that distribution is very big, right? You know that people are experiencing games in radically different ways. But to actually get down into the detail of what those differences are at such a scale through thousands of comments is like, it's just, I have loved it. I want to do that again and again and again.
We are so different. I would hate that.
Why would you hate it?
I would find it interesting as far as how people think and interact with the game. But what I would hate is the amount of time it would take to organize all that information and to like extrapolate what parts of it are worth keeping, because most of it is going to be garbage.
Yeah, a stupid amount of time.
And I feel like it'd be significantly easier to do it on a game that I was not a part of versus a game that I created. Reading comments can like hurt a designer's ego pretty bad. And it's like, I'm pretty chill on a lot of things, but I remember like you would send me stuff about her story and I'm just like, oh, well, that person clearly didn't shuffle the deck because they said it was just set collection. That means they didn't have any text abilities. So sometimes there's like things where I can be like, oh, well, I know why that was rated poorly. But then other times I'm just like, wow, this person's just like being rude to be rude.
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
We had like an Instagram video that happened with like caution signs, and the amount of people are like just basically went, so it's Pictionary. I was like, no. I was like, play the freaking game, bro. I think I would get driven a little crazy.
I will say that this has been another way that like I've helped like tamp my ego down, you know, like when you read the 600 comment that's negative about something, it stops being a big emotional deal.
Oh yeah, you just become numb to it.
Yeah, so then you get into a very analytical space, and then it's easier to think because your emotions aren't messing with you.
That's fair. I think also just because I do a lot of things and the time I want to devote to stuff, I would prefer to work on like some new creative pursuit over looking at the strengths and faults of, but I mean, yeah, I probably would be a better designer if I started going through those rabbit holes. So maybe I'll put it on the list.
Yeah, well, I mean, it may depend on the personality too. Like, you know, as you know, I'm like a really analytical person, so this is catnip for me. For another personality type, it may not be the best avenue toward improvement.
So then what did you find to be your favorite and least favorite experience of working on the second edition?
Well, yeah, my favorite experience is probably what I just described, the sort of the kaleidoscopic detail in the understanding I developed by reading every comment that exists online about the first edition. That was just incredible. What was my least favorite? Oh, yeah, at the start of the project, I did not start with the idea that I would completely change out the core mechanics. You know, I started out with the idea that we would just sort of finesse the math on the existing core mechanics to try to fix the problem. That process of trying to do that was like, I think, 3 or 4 months, during which I made close to zero progress. The frustration of that was like just rage inducing. There were times when I was like punching the walls, you know? So that was hard. Although it did make the catharsis of finally figuring out what to do better.
I feel like some designers are more, I can focus on this one problem until I figure it out. Or for me, I just move on to a different game. And then eventually when I come back, it's like a new set of eyes. And then it's like, I found the solution or whatever. And everyone's so different.
That's true for me as well. If I work really hard on a problem and then set it aside and then come back to it later. I remember reading that Stephen King, as a rule, will write his first draft of a novel, then he'll put it in a safety deposit box for a year, and then come back and rewrite it.
You told me that. I remember you saying that. I was like, oh, interesting.
I think this is a universal thing. So, however, because I am making games in a studio for a company, I'm on salary, that means there's a burn rate for what I'm doing. I cannot afford to be too slow or I will get fired. I have to figure out how to maintain or achieve the level of quality that we're going for within that constraint, which creates a totally different set of pressures, you know, than if you're like licensing games, you know.
That's definitely true. I try to explain that to people when they're like, oh, my life goal is like be a full-time designer. It's like, yeah, that's really cool. But also you have to think of things like, what if you have a death in the family or a breakup? But like, it changes your mental space, and your mental space can affect your creativity. Where if you're just like, oh, I had an idea and I'm making it on the side of like during my day job or whatever, like I actually enjoy the fact that my day job, the most creative I get to be is like the product design and working with artists, but that has nothing to do with my creative space. Like everything else is like mostly organizing, being a project director, where I can then work on the creative pursuits outside of my job. So it's kind of nice that my mental state will never affect what is going to give me my salary. We've talked about quite a few advices, but if you could pick something that we haven't already discussed as an advice to designers, what would you give them?
Okay, I'll talk about the other thing that I think has helped me most advance as a game designer in the last, say, three-ish years. A few years ago, I started creating this document to try to capture the game design principles by which we would do our work in our studio. Every time that some idea or change to the principles, we have some idea about how to change the principles, I change the document. And so I've been editing this document, adding to it for a few years now, and it has become essential. So basically, like designing a really good game, especially a strategy game, requires getting dozens of dimensions right to create this like gestalt experience that's really good. And in many cases, if you get, you know, like one or two of those dimensions wrong in some way, it can spoil the whole brew. So basically, my feeling now is that the complexity of designing a really good game is actually a little bit more than like a typical human brain can handle, unless you're like Reiner Nitzia or something. This document has made it so much easier to become clear about what we're trying to do and why. And it's helped me avoid a lot of mistakes that I am sure I would have otherwise. So that's a big thing. I have one other thing. I mentioned I interview customers, but I interview them in a really specific way. There's this book, which has probably affected me more in my professional life than any other book I've ever read. It's called Competing Against Luck by Clayton Christensen, who's a sort of very famous business thinker.
Yeah, I've read it. You guys had me have a book list when I got hired. You're the only one who ever came with a reading requirement.
Yeah. That book taught me that like there are lots and lots of ways to interview people through which you'll either get nothing or you'll come to the wrong conclusions. And the main thing, if I can summarize it all, is never ask speculative questions. Don't ask people like, what would you like more, this or this, or what are you most interested in, or how would you like us to do this? Don't ever do that. Instead, you ask people to tell their stories about the role that certain products, like the kind you're trying to make, have played in their lives. Like how did they first hear about a product? What's the next step they took? What's the story of how they came to buy it? Once it's in their lives, what role has it played in their lives? So for board games, it's who do you play it with? You know, like when have you played it? How much have you played it? All this. And you go into great detail about that. And through that, you sort of understand the sort of jobs that whatever product is doing in a person's life. And through repetition of those kinds of stories, you can have a clearer idea of what it is you're trying to do. Games in particular are many different things to many different people, and they do very different jobs for different people. And if you don't understand that, if you don't understand what jobs you're trying to like optimize for, you'll often like make a thing that doesn't do any of the jobs right, you know?
No, I appreciated learning how to interview when I was working with you guys and talking to a customer and about their experience. I always teach games. When I teach one of my prototypes, I teach it as a story. I find that because I play with people that are not like gamers that know all the mechanics, that teaching it in that way has always made things easier for them to grasp and like understand why it is that a mechanic was chosen, not knowing what the mechanic actually is named or what it does. I think that's really cool. And I would highly recommend a lot of different kinds of books outside of gaming, because I know people tend to talk about like Jamie Stagmeier's like Kickstarter book or whatever, but there's a lot of interesting ones about just how people think and work with products that you guys made me read, but also I already read a lot of those kinds of books, and I think that helped me as a designer.
Yeah, I have to say, so before I was a game designer, I was a neurobiologist. And so from that time, I know a lot about sort of how people think, you know, universal principles by which people think. And wow, has that ever been helpful in game design? Because at a fundamental level, a game design is psychology.
I have a psych degree, so
there you
agreed.
Go. There you go.
Random things. Never knew game design would be an option for the future, but I have a graphic design degree and a psychology, and both are super duper useful.
Yeah, that's the other one, graphic design. And actually, a great graphic designer thinks like they deeply know human perception, human visual perception. So there's psychology to that. And that is also ridiculously valuable for game design. We were talking about Charlie Bink. He's a high-level graphic designer, and I can just watch the way that it makes it easier for him to make choices in game design.
Agreed. So cool. So does Underdog have any other projects that fans should be looking out for? Or you yourself as a designer?
Well, yeah, so at the moment, we don't have any like super major projects coming up, but we do have a new version of our game, Secret Clue, that will be released early next year. And Danielle, I would turn this around on you because you happen to be the designer of it. So would you like to explain Secret Clue to the audience?
Oh, sure. Yeah, so Secret Clue is a 15-minute or less co-op deduction game. So you have one person giving silent clues, and the first game, it's Secret Clue Animals. So you're putting out pictures of different cute animals to get them to guess out of this 3x3 grid of 9 cards. And kind of like with Codenames, you have yourself a little grid that shows the first, the second, and the third animal that they need to guess. And when they're putting down cards, they're putting down 3 cards split between either the similar or dissimilar spots. So it's like Maybe you have a mammal you're trying to get everyone to guess. So you put like a polar bear trying to get them to guess, even though it's a beaver. And it's like, okay, well, that's like, it's a mammal. That's why I did that. And then maybe I also have this reptile that's like darker colored to like match it. So it's really cool because you get to dive into people's brains, and different ages think differently. Like kids love to give clues like, that's a happy animal. Where me, I tend to go like, oh, is it a mammal? Is it a reptile? Is it a water? Or does it like fly? Or like, what does it eat? So that was a really fun one to work on. I'm excited for the second one to come out. So it's cuisines. And honestly, when I made the first initial three different versions, cuisines was my favorite. So I'm excited that that one's coming out because the pictures make you so hungry.
Yeah.
And I made sure to choose like different foods that I have not even tried. Like I actually spent this year most of February in Asia, and I got to try a lot of the foods that were inside of the game. So I was very happy about that.
Yeah, I have to tell you, this is the only game I've worked on that has made me gain weight. I think I'm like 5 pounds heavier from looking at those pictures. I'll be like looking at them, and then I'll be like, I gotta go upstairs and I gotta eat something.
Yeah, no, you definitely shouldn't play that on an empty stomach. But it's perfect if you're like, parents are wrapping up, making food. I have played it many times while like someone's making brunch or something.
Yeah.
And I'll play with their kids. That's actually where some of the play tests came in.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I'm super excited. It's also because it's like my first system that's carrying on into different themes. And it's with National Geographic, which is a license that many, I'm sure, have wanted to work with. So
yeah, that's an important point. It's a National Geographic game, which is really cool. We love National Geographic because their sensibility is really similar to Underdog's. And a little bit of context about Secret Clue. People often say that it's like a combination of Similo and Codenames. And it is sort of like, you might describe it as like my first deduction game in a way. It's like a deduction game that you can play with a seven-year-old and have them understand. And that's really the biggest use case. Like if you want to introduce your kids to deduction, it's a good one to do it with.
Completely agree. And it's also fun because on the back of every card, like any Underdog game, you get to learn. So if you don't know what that food item is, or you don't know what that animal does, like boom, right there. So then maybe you're going to have some recipes you need to check out in the future.
That's right. Yeah.
Awesome. Well then for my last question, completely unrelated to anything we've already talked about, what is a game that you wish you had been the designer of?
Can I pick like a couple of different genres?
No, you get one.
I get one? All right.
You get one.
All right. I will. Damn. Okay. Okay, that's fine. So, you know, we make gateway games at Underdog. So, like, the amount of time that I've spent studying gateway games in the last however many years is, like, way higher than any other genre. So, I feel most qualified to answer this one. So, that's the genre I'll pick.
Okay.
And I will pick King of Tokyo. I think that is an absolute masterpiece of game design. The way that it allows... So, I mean, probably most people who are listening to this know, but just in case, King of Tokyo takes the mechanics of Yahtzee, where you're rolling dice and re-rolling the dice that you don't want a couple of times, and then turns it into a game about kaiju destroying Tokyo and mauling each other. And it does it in like this incredibly fun way where it feels light and breezy and all kinds of dramatic, goofy things can happen in this game. But at the same time, there's like subtlety under the hood. There's all kinds of little nuances of probability that you can discover if you're really into it. And I'm crazy into it. Also, just like the number of people that I've introduced King of Tokyo to who have gone on to become gamers is really high, which I think speaks to its incredible ability to convey what's beautiful about modern games.
All right. That's a good answer. Good job. I'm glad you picked one.
Thank you. It's really hard not for me to say another one, but I won't do it.
Don't do it. Save it for some other interview. Well, thank you so much to everyone who's been listening to this episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 103, Trekking the World, second edition. And thanks again, Nick, for being on the show. I know you're super huge into like X, but like where else can you be found, either you personally, but also Underdog Games?
Yeah, actually, the place where I do the most communicating about what I do and what Underdog is doing is through our advisor group. So this is a private group. You won't find it publicly, but if you go to Underdog's website at underdoggames.com, you can sign up for that, and then you'll see a lot of stuff. Yeah, on X, I haven't been posting as much as I used to.
What? That used to be like your social experiment.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, with the ownership change of X, a lot of the board game people have just left, and it makes it less sort of inspiring to post there. So I'm actually kind of looking for a public home to post about the things I like to post about, and I just haven't found it yet.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, then maybe don't find you there.
Yeah.
All right. And I'm your host, Danielle Reynolds. If you're trying to find me on social media, you can go under Token Gamer, and that's spelled G-A-Y-M-E-R, and that's on like Instagram, X, Blue Sky. And then I have a website that I just updated recently, dmrcreativegroup.com, if you want to see all the media stuff I've done, as well as any games I'm working on. Thanks for being on the show, Nick. This was great. It was always fun chatting.
Thank you very much, Danielle.
Thank you for joining Danielle for another episode of Game Design Unboxed, inspiration to publication. If you'd like to hear more great gaming podcasts, check out nodirectionpodcast.com. And if you're looking for a great board game, bag, playmat, or table, check out All Play at letsallplay.com. Join us next time.